Today's sermon, not to bore you to tears, but is on another kind of unwholesome talk. And you recall, we've touched on two or three things already. We've touched on falsehood and truthfulness. Of course, grudges was not an aspect of unwholesome talk. We touched on stealing. But as we looked at unwholesome talk, we realized that it includes obscenity and profanity, and we talked a little bit about dirty jokes and some of those other kinds of things. And then the last time we were together, we talked about gossiping, which is unwholesome talk, which doesn't necessarily involve bad words or good words used in the bad context, but it's unwholesome talk that tears someone else down, but the distinguishing characteristic is they aren't present when it's said, right? So gossip is unwholesome talk behind someone's back. And we talked in some detail about the damage that that does, and really the spirit that's behind that is the same spirit that began sin and rebellion in the first place. When Lucifer, back in heaven, first began to have questions and issues with God, he didn't go dealing with God directly. He began to spread his problems, his issues, and his questions all around heaven to all the other beings and try to discredit God before the rest of heaven. And when we engage in that same kind of activity, we are partaking of that same spirit. But that's not the only way that you can use perfectly good words to tear someone down. The other way is to do it when they're present. Now, we might call that criticism. We might call that insult. But for our purposes today, I'm going to focus on one aspect of this that I think is correctly named verbal abuse. Verbal abuse. Verbal abuse, just broadly speaking, is just another way of saying I'm going to tear someone down with my words while they're present, right? And so we could say that verbal abuse happens in all kinds of settings. But the interesting thing about it is that it's largely self-limiting when it happens between strangers, right? You're out on the freeway, and you accidentally do something that the guy in the next car over doesn't like, and he shakes his fist at you and calls you names and verbally abuses you. How long is that going to bother you?
30 seconds.
Yeah, Carol, good for you. 30. Well, as long as it doesn't and turn into bullets flying, all right, and other things, which happens these days, we're relatively easily able to sort of shake off verbal abuse from a stranger because, you know what, I don't have a relationship with that person. I don't need them to like me. And it's not going to ruin the rest of my life if they're not pleased with me. And I'm probably never going to see that person again. So who cares? And the fact is, their power to harm me is limited because I have the freedom to say, you know what? I don't need to hang around here and listen to this. I can go somewhere else where people are nice to me. And we do, typically, with strangers. I heard one pastor tell about his own experience of getting angry with the next driver over, and when they stopped at the stoplight, he, you know, let him know how disgusted he was with the guy's driving. Now, this is the pastor telling the story, was disgusted with the driving. And the guy looked at him and he said, "I don't even know you." And drove off. And upon reflection, the pastor said, "You know what? He was right. Why should he care that I'm bent out of shape about his driving? He doesn't have any relationship with me." He said that it was actually a healthy response to my bad attitude. to say, I don't even know you. So, verbal abuse is largely self-limiting in the public arena. If you're nasty, you reap what you sow. People will leave you alone to enjoy your own company. I like the story I heard about some parents who were trying to teach their kid that while they were small. And when the kids were rude, they'd send them down to their room and say, now you go on down to your room. And while you're at it, if you'd like to, you can throw a fit. Take a look at yourself in the mirror there and see if it's up to your standards. And the kid was learning from that, that when I'm sweet and nice, I get to be around the people that are important to me in my life. And when I'm nasty and rude, I get to spend time by myself with my mirror examining, you know, whether I'm enjoyable to be around or not. And the parent's goal was, if I can teach my kid this when they're small, maybe the fourth wife won't be still trying to explain it to him when she divorces him. Anyway, so much better to learn that you reap what you sow when you're small. But here's the really frightening thing about verbal abuse. Like I said, it's largely self-limiting when it's between strangers, when it's in the public arena. But there are some situations where, because people have established ties and relationships, where verbal abuse becomes entrenched, where it becomes actually a way of life. And it doesn't go away because the person who's doing it does not ever experience the consequence, right? The appropriate consequence is, look, I'd be happy to be around when you can talk nicely to me. But there are cases and situations where that never happens. And the scary thing is that the verbal abuser actually becomes emboldened by their success, if we think of it that way, and tends to perpetuate, and that tends to perpetuate and escalate the problem. In other words, the more you get away with speaking to someone in a demeaning and nasty way, the easier it is to continue speaking to someone in a demeaning and nasty way. And I think I'll explain some more about this as I go along. But when somebody is demeaning, they actually discount your experience of the problem. If you start to object and say, I don't like this, they say, well, you just don't have a sense of humor. You know, it was just a joke. And they actually will verbally tell you, you're wrong. I'm not abusing you. And so you become conditioned to being abused, and they become conditioned to getting away with it. And it turns into a very nasty cycle that just continues. So, I want to expose a little bit of this today. Because the fact is, the reason why it continues, in most cases, is because the people who are on the short end of the stick, right, that are being abused, don't recognize what's really going on. And the people who are doing it, it's working. So they're not motivated to change. And unless people can understand what's really going on, it's not going to change. So you may have been or may be in a verbally abusive relationship at work. Maybe you were in a verbally abusive relationship at home when you were a kid with your parents. This is, you know, it's very common for parents to treat their children, maybe not hitting them physically, but to damage them with words. And why, well, I'm going to talk about this more later, but why in the world would kids put up with that?
They don't have any other choice, they aren't allowed to leave.
Right. They go, well, where am I going to go? Now, the fact is, kids do have options, and they could leave. And when it gets bad enough, kids run away from home. But because there is this established relationship and tie, and I'll explain a little bit more about that later, it doesn't seem obvious to the kid. And if you start small, abusing them, you can condition them to accept more and more and more and more and more. And that's what happens. So probably all of us, at some point or another, have been in a verbally abusive relationship, either when we were kids at home or in a work situation where an employer abused their influence over you because you wanted to hold on to your job, or maybe with a spouse. Probably all of us have been on the receiving end of it. And I suspect that some of us have been on the giving end of it in different situations, as parents, as spouses, it's entirely possible. So I'm not going to, you know, ask you, well, I may ask you, have you ever done that? But I'm not trying to ferret anybody out here, okay? But education, understanding, may help you in a present situation. It may help you in a future situation. It may help you with somebody else that you know who is in a present situation. All right, so the really frightening part about verbal abuse is when it becomes entrenched. When the person who's being abused doesn't realize what's going on, and instead of saying, I don't need to hang around for this, they spend all their mental energy thinking, well, what did I do that set him off? Pardon? Yeah, I breathed. Yeah, well, exactly. Because that's actually the wrong question, right? Just so you're clear on that. That is the wrong question. Because verbal abuse is not about what the person who's abused did wrong. It's entirely about power. It's all about power. And not just any power, because there's good power and there's bad power. Verbal abuse is about having power over someone else. Me being in a one-up position and them being in a one-down position. The abuser's goal is to maintain power over the abused person. There's never any excuse, especially among us resurrected Christian people, right, who have a new life, never any excuse for flying off the handle at someone. To say, well, she made me angry, is a lie. Nobody makes someone else angry. Each of us, by our own interpretation of the situation, decides whether it's something to be angry about or not. How else can you explain Paul and Silas when they were in prison? Right? They've been beaten up. They're thrown in stocks. It's a dark dungeon. It's the middle of the night. They're in pain. They're bleeding. And they're singing at the top of their lungs, praise to God. How could they do that? Their beliefs about the situation allowed them to say, you know what, it's an honor to be beaten for Christ. It's an honor to suffer for Christ. It's an honor to be imprisoned for Christ. Let's praise and thank Him for this opportunity. Now, we sort of laugh because that almost sounds crazy. Different association. Anyway, but the reality is Paul and Silas were seeing reality clearly. Because in the big scheme of things, it is more honorable and better to suffer for Christ, who can reward you with an eternity of wonderful things, than to, for instance, go along with this world, damaging other people, abusing other people, throwing people in prison for not doing anything wrong. Now, you might be comfortable and be able to live in your house and have food to eat, but the end result, you're going to be sorry. And so they said, hey, we're in a better position than the people that threw us in here. I'd certainly rather be beaten up and thrown in prison, you know, for Christ than not to know Him, than to be on the other side of things. I read the most fascinating story about the Rwanda genocide. You all remember the news stories about that? This is the story of it was largely over, I guess you could say, over kind of a tribal warfare. There were two tribes, Hutus and Tutsis. The Tutsis were being murdered, mass murdered by the Hutus, basically, during this genocide. But there were at least two groups of Hutus as well, and maybe you could divide them up even finer than that. But there were those that really wanted to kill the Tutsis and were out to doing all that they could. And there were those that were being dragged along unwillingly and involved in the killing unwillingly simply because of their tribal ties. And they didn't want to kill Tutsis, but they were brought to the place where all of us Hutus are killing all those Tutsis, and if you don't kill them, we'll kill you. Right? So there's the extremists, those being murdered, And then there's this group in the middle that doesn't want to be involved, but are being forced to be involved upon threat of death. Now, the author of the story was a Tutsi and miraculously survived the genocide. I mean, just miracle after miracle, 5 minutes apart, he would show people his ID card, and you know, which clearly said he was a Tutsi, and they would still let him go through the roadblocks where other people were just being mowed down with machetes, you know, on every side. But he said, and this was interesting, in the situation, he said, "I was glad to be a Tutsi. I would hate to have been a moderate Hutu who didn't want to be involved." Because he said, as a victim in the situation, I knew my place. I knew they were going to kill me. But if I had been a Hutu and resistant to being involved, I would never have known what was going to happen. You know, because you're not the target unless you don't want to participate, then you are the target. He said that would have been a horrible situation to be in. Anyway, so Paul and Silas had that reality. They said, we'd rather be the victims in this situation than the perpetrators. And they were able to praise God, even in the midst of this horrible situation. All that was simply to say that your circumstances and your situation do not make you angry. They don't make you bite off somebody's head. They don't make you snap at someone. It's your own interpretation of the situation that leads to that kind of thing. And verbal abuse is never the fault of the person being abused. It's always an issue in the person doing the abusing. Listen to this interaction, right? This is a story told by a lady, her experience with her husband in this case. Jack walks into the room and flops heavily into a chair near Anne, and he says casually, "Boy, are you uncooperative." Anne is slightly perplexed. She says, "Well, why do you think that?" Jack answers, "Because you didn't help me pick up the fruit, or pick the fruit." Anne responds, "But I didn't know you were picking the fruit." "Well, I was." Now let's analyze that for just a second. How is Anne feeling at this point? Right? Exasperated? What else? And why is she feeling exasperated?
Beyond her control.
Yeah, because she's just been condemned and blamed for something that she couldn't have fixed if she wanted to. Right? How else might she be feeling?
Hurt.
Yes, why?
Because she was being accused of something that she had no way of knowing was going on, and
yeah,
the person that she loved was accusing her of.
Yes, a person that she loved is telling her that she is uncooperative when she knows in her heart that she didn't want to be, she didn't intend to be, and here he's producing this evidence that she's uncooperative and trying to label her as uncooperative, and it's coming from someone who she loves. Yeah, how else might she be feeling? Anybody have an additional perspective?
How about Martha with her sister in the Bible?
Well, that's an interesting story. I hadn't thought of it in this context. But what are you thinking of?
Well, I was thinking when Martha went to Christ and says, you know, here I'm doing all the work and my sister is...
Yeah. Yeah, very similar to this guy coming in and saying, "I did all the work and you didn't help me."
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So she's feeling rotten, right, for something that we can clearly see as we look at the interaction was entirely his issue. Right. Apparently he didn't even ask her. He didn't tell her he was going out and picking the fruit. But he comes in and then wants to blame her for himself being angry about something that she failed to do. Well, so Jack's goal through the entire interaction, what seems to be his purpose? What's he trying to accomplish here? Yeah, to pick a fight, to blame someone else for his own anger. It seems like he's simply trying to make her feel rotten. And then tell her that it's her own fault that she feels rotten because she's so uncooperative. If that wasn't his goal, he would have asked for help in the first place. Right? Or he would have acknowledged that it's unreasonable for her to, for him to expect her to read his mind. But instead he says, well, I was, you know, and she says, I didn't know. Well, I was picking it as in, as if she should have known somehow and read his mind. Now, if at the end, instead of saying, well, I was, if he'd said, well, I guess I'm just upset because I wish you had noticed and offered to help. It would have been an unpleasant interaction, certainly. But at least he would be admitting, it's my issue, and it's my fault, and it really wasn't reasonable for me to expect that from you. He would have been, it could have validated her experience and restored the trust in the relationship if he had had that kind of response. But in the absence of this kind of closure, the abuser gains a sense of superiority, right? I told her how it is. And the abused person gains a sense of discouragement. Well, I must be a horrible, uncooperative person or he wouldn't treat me this way. And the situation deteriorates. Now, one author that I read who talks about this suggests that here's some of what's going on, right? A person who is a verbal abuser lives, we might say, in an alternate reality, one in which the only way to feel good about yourself is at the expense of someone else. I don't know if that makes sense to you. I'll try to keep explaining. The verbal abuser lives in a world in which competition reigns. If you achieve something good, then it reflects poorly on me. I actually heard one father tell his son, when the son asked, "What, you know, why don't you ever notice I get good grades? And you've never made a comment ever about the positive work that I'm doing in school." The father told his son, "Well, what am I supposed to say when you get better grades than I did?" Now, what is wrong with this picture? Is there a competition between father and son over? But in the minds of that father, there was. There was. The verbal abuser lives in a world in which nothing good can happen to anyone else without them feeling like something bad has happened to them. If I don't dominate you, you'll dominate me. If I don't hit you first, you'll hit me. It's an eat or be eaten world of distrust and manipulation. Real relationships don't exist there. Real relationships exist where cooperation and trust are the foundation, where I can be as glad for something good happening to you as I would be if it happened to me. But people who are in a verbally abusive relationship, who are being verbally abused, often don't realize that the problem is the abuser's understanding of reality. Their twisted view of life that says nothing good can happen to anybody else without something bad happening to me. And that was how Martha interpreted the situation, right? If Mary gets to sit there and do what she wants, then that means something horrible is happening to me. I'm being mistreated. She couldn't rejoice that Mary was getting something good and be glad that Mary was getting something good. She interpreted everything in, well, how does it affect me? Oh, it must be bad for me if it's good for her. People who are being verbally abused don't realize that's what's going on. And so they assume the abuser must have some good reason to be getting on their case. And that's what we saw in this story. And says, well, why do you think that? He comes in, boy, are you uncooperative. Well, the fact is, that's a completely ridiculous and outrageous thing to say to someone. If it was a total stranger saying it to her, she'd say, what? But because it was someone who cares about her, she assumes, well, he must have some reason to say a thing like that. I wonder what I did. And that never works. You can't solve the problem that way because that's not really the issue. The issue is the abuser wants to have some reason to put the other person down. They want to have some reason to feel more powerful than the other person. And like you said, if you didn't fail to pick the fruit, you get yelled at because you breathed. So what does verbal abuse look like? I'm going to briefly describe some categories of verbal abuse and give some examples. It comes in all sorts of different flavors. But here's the first one. And for now, I don't want you to try to remember all these categories or to write them. I mean, you can write them down if you want. The point is not to remember them all. For now, I just want you to think, have I ever heard any of these things being spoken to me or spoken to somebody else that I know? Or have any of these things ever come out of my mouth? If you want a reference to read more about them, they're taken from a book by a lady named Patricia Evans. The book is entitled The Verbally Abusive Relationship. Patricia Evans, The Verbally Abusive Relationship. The first category is withholding. Now remember we said that the silent treatment, we said this a long time ago, the silent treatment can be a form of unwholesome talk, right? Nothing's coming out of your mouth. But it is still potentially a way of demeaning the other person. It's also possible for a person not to be totally silent, but to withhold information in order to maintain control. Now, that might mean withholding financial information if we're talking about a marriage situation. Or maybe just personal information, just remaining aloof. Not sharing deeply from your heart who you are is a way of maintaining power in a relationship because you're invulnerable. The other person doesn't know you. They don't know what you care about, so they can't hurt you. How many of you have been in a situation where you would like to have gotten close to someone and gotten to know them and they wouldn't let you? They just kind of, right? So some of you have had that experience that withholding information can be a way of sabotaging a relationship and of saying, in essence, to the other person, you're not worth sharing my heart with. Often, a woman named Cora tells this experience. This, again, is a husband-wife situation. She says, I didn't know what to do. For a while there, I thought that if I were somehow more interesting or more entertaining, that maybe he'd talk to me once in a while. I guess I really started thinking something was wrong when I was over at a friend's house and her husband came in and started telling her about a fellow he'd met at the tennis court. I couldn't remember my husband ever sharing like that. The person who's withholding may pretend not to hear, so they don't have to get into a conversation, act like they didn't hear you. Or they might get into another activity. You know, pick up the newspaper while someone's talking to them and say, yeah, go ahead, I'm listening. But they don't share themselves. You know, they engage themselves in some of their activity in order to avoid sharing with the person. The withholder will respond to requests for communication. So when somebody says, please, can we talk? Or, you know, you don't ever talk to me. They'll respond with things like this. There's nothing to talk about. Well, what do you want me to say? What are you complaining about? I do talk to you. Or, you never let me talk. Or how about this one? Well, why should I give you my opinion? You'll do whatever you want anyway. Or, you wouldn't be interested to hear what I have to say. A person who always keeps you guessing by withholding is after one thing. Power. They're trying to maintain their position over you in a relationship. Countering. This is one that I've seen a lot. And actually, it's one of the main things that at least in marriage relationships, that people do. Since verbal abuse is about power and maintaining power over another person, anytime an abuser's partner expresses an independent view or opinion, guess how the abuser views that? It's a threat. If you have your own opinion and you have your own viewpoint, then I might be losing control of you. You might become an independent person and realize what I'm doing and leave me to enjoy my own company. And so very often in an abusive relationship, verbally abusive relationship, when the partner who's being abused expresses an opinion, the abuser will counter it. Just like that. No, it's not. Here's one brief story. This is a woman whose husband's name is Kurt. She says, Kurt had just joined me outside. I noticed the clouds moving in and the cool moisture in the air, and I thought maybe we'll get a little thunder shower. Right? So she's noticing the weather, finding it interesting. She turned to Kurt and said, I think that maybe when the weather changes rapidly from hot to cold, there's a greater chance. I was angrily interrupted with, it's not cold, it's cool. Now, what's the point of that? The whole point in what's going on here is maintaining control, denying the other person the right to their own opinion, telling them, you have to agree with me about everything. Anybody ever heard that? Seen it? Anybody ever done that? I know that I have. That was modeled to me very well when I was growing up. And so I find that, you know, that just comes out my mouth without even thinking about it sometimes. With Karina, she'll say something and I have to correct it. The abused person will often assume they were too forthright, right? That they were too bold in offering their opinion. But the problem is not that they were too opinionated. The problem is that the abuser is threatened by any opinion at all. And what happens is, and I've noticed this even with Karina, she'll become more and more meek about sharing her opinion because she doesn't want it to be shot down. And when I recognize that's what's going on, I tell her, you don't have to, you know, qualify your opinion with everything. I need to respect your opinion no matter what. You know, but she'll say, well, do you think maybe possibly we could... And I just go, whoa, you know, am I so dangerous to share anything with? Yeah. Discounting. If the partner says, I feel hurt when you said that, or I don't think that's very funny, the abusive person will say something like the following. Well, you're too sensitive. You can't take a joke. You blow everything out of proportion. You're making a big deal out of nothing. Where's your sense of humor? You feel too much. Your imagination is working overtime. You think you know everything. You always have to have something to complain about. You're always trying to start something. You take everything the wrong way. This is a particularly damaging form of abuse because it specifically tells the person who's being abused, you're not being abused. It's all in your head. And when a person is told that and told that and told that, they begin to wonder, am I out of my mind? But guess who's not in reality? It's the abuser who's not in reality, not the person being abused. The abuser is the one who's so crazy that they think you should hang around when I treat you this way. That's nuts. That's not in touch with the real reality. Abusive jokes. These are derogatory comments, any kind of derogatory comment, which the abuser will excuse as a joke. Woman driver. When she says, I don't think that's very nice, I say, you just can't take a joke. How many of you have seen people joking about their spouse or someone else and playing it off like it was a joke? Right? That's not cool. And that's a form of verbal abuse, and it's a power game. It's a way of demeaning the other person and maintaining a position of superiority. Blocking and diverting. These are techniques an abuser uses to control the topic of conversation, right? Because they don't want to be confronted about what they're doing wrong. They don't want to have to answer to anybody. They want to be the one in charge. So they will actually block and divert the conversation with some of these tricks. When somebody doesn't want to explain something, they'll say, "You're just trying to have the last word." Or, "You know what I meant." Or, "You heard me. I shouldn't have to repeat myself." Or, "Will you get off my back? Just drop it." Or, "You always have to be right." Or, "Did anybody ask you?" Or, "Where did you get that dumb idea?" All of those are just, you know, they just block off the conversation so that we can't go where the person who was asking a question or whatever was trying to go. Blocking can also be done by diversion, by changing the subject. One woman's husband spent $40,000 on unexplained business expenses in a year, right? When he brought her the tax return to sign, because she had to sign the tax, you know, it was her money too, it's community property, the way the law works. But she never knew that all this money had come in and gone out. But she had to sign the tax return, and when she saw the 40 grand, she wanted to know where it went. Here are some diversionary responses that he might have used. "What are you worried about? You have plenty to spend." Did that answer the question? No. It just changes the subject to something else. Makes it sound like she's trying to start a fight. "I'm not going to explain to you how the corporate retirement accounts are set up." What does that imply? "You're too dumb to understand anyway. Don't complain to me until you're earning $200,000 a year." What does that imply? Yeah, your value in this relationship compared to mine is greatly diminished because I earn most of the money and you don't. Is that true? It's an absolute lie, and it's a demeaning thing to say to someone, even though you didn't come right out and say it. "Do I have to count for every penny?" How many pennies? Yeah. "If you think you can do a better job, then you do the taxes, and I'll quit work." That's a threat. The end result is that the legitimate question is never answered, and the abused person is being disparaged for even asking it. Accusing and blaming. This is when the abuser will blame the abused for his or her bad feelings. So the partner says, "I feel distant and closed off from you." And the abuser says, "I don't need to be attacked like that." Or, "You're just looking for trouble. You're attacking me. You can't leave well enough alone." Turning the problem back, blaming it on the person who wasn't the source of the problem, accusing them of starting it. Judging and criticizing. Now, you'd asked a little bit about, is it ever okay to criticize, to, you know, be honest with someone about where there's a problem? And yes, it is. But it can also be a verbally abusive act to say things like, "The trouble with you is," that's not likely to precede some legitimate, right? This is just a way of saying something's wrong with you. Statements such as, "I can't believe you did that again," or "What's wrong with you?" or questions that have no good answer. Such as, "What did you do that for?" "Well, because I'm stupid." Now, is there a good answer to that question? No, there's no good. It's just an implied insult. So, judging and criticizing. You've got the picture. Trivializing. All right. A woman named Lee tells this story. "The other day, I achieved an effect in my painting that I've been striving for. I was really excited about it, and that evening I told my husband, Luke, that I'd finally got my painting to work the way I wanted. And he said, in a really sarcastic voice, 'Well, isn't it nice to have something to do in the daytime?'" What's he trying to say? Yeah, get a real job. You finally achieved something in your painting, but how trivial it is. How useless, and how, you know, that doesn't matter. Now, that seems obviously hostile to me, right? But it can really confuse someone who isn't expecting it. They'll sit there and wonder why their abuser can't understand how much they care about something. Undermining. Undermining is a way of eroding the confidence of someone else, such as, why bother? Or who cares? In response to an idea or an opinion or examples of this. So are comments like, well, you wouldn't get it, or you'll never make it, or who are you trying to impress? One woman tells this story. I was feeling really good when I told my husband that I had thought of a plot for a story I'd like to write. He listened nicely and then said, really, I can't think of anyone who'd be interested to read something like that. I sort of lost my enthusiasm. Undermining can also include interrupting when the partner's in a conversation with someone else and finishing their story. It implies that you're not capable of doing this yourself, or you won't do it right. The abused person's will to do anything is undermined because the abuser may just come in and interrupt it, stomp on it, break it up, block it. Threatening is another form of verbal abuse. You do what I say, or I'll leave, or I'll divorce you. I'll hit you. Name calling. This is one of the most obvious things. I just hope you're clear. Name calling in any form is verbal abuse. The only exception would be terms of endearment. Yes. Right? And even terms of endearment can be verbal abuse if they're said in a sarcastic way. Yes, dear. But to call someone an idiot, you remember what Jesus had to say about that? I think I'm coming to that later. Anyone who says, you fool, is in danger of the fires of hell? Jesus didn't approve of name calling. And we'll look at why in just a second. Another thing, forgetting. Forgetting. Often after a fight, the person who got the short end of the stick will want to come back and make up. And, you know, they're interested in talking it out and dealing with the problem and resolving it. And one way of maintaining power in the relationship is to never let them resolve it. And so the abuser will conveniently have forgotten all about it. Oh, I don't remember that fight. What are you talking about? You're making this up. Are you trying to start a fight? Sometimes abusers will consistently forget important promises, or forget to pass on important messages. Or they'll say things like, I don't know where you got that. I never agreed to that. Ordering treats the other person like they have no life or wishes besides their own. Get in here and clean this up. You're not wearing that. Where's my dinner? Denial. This is when the person doesn't forget, where they just say, I never said that. You're making it all up. We never had that conversation. You're getting all upset about nothing. I don't know where you get that. You've got to be crazy. These are all examples of denial when the abused person knows full well that the other person did say it, that he or she is not making it up, that they did have that conversation, and so on. The final category of verbal abuse is really no particular phrases, but abuse of anger, and it really goes through all of them. One quick story. A woman says, Bert agreed to go to a marriage counselor with me. At the counselor's, he heard me say that I felt hurt and fear when he would yell at me. Right? This, in the controlled setting of the counseling, she was able to tell him that. After we left, he yelled at me again, saying I'd attacked and blindsided him. I was confused. Abusive anger is never really about the thing the person's angry about. It's a response to a backlog of insecurity that the person carries around inside themselves that boils up and spills out like a geyser on an unpredictable schedule. It gives the abuser a rush, a feeling of power, and it makes the abused person feel off balance. we're going to close up here shortly. Just a couple more notes about how verbal abuse works in a relationship. Verbal abusers are often only abusive in private. Everybody else thinks they're wonderfully nice people, right? But in a situation where it's just the abuser and the abused, they'll be really nasty. And so when the abused person tries to get help and says, you know, my husband, for instance, is treating me really badly, everybody else goes, are you sure? You're not, you know, a little crazy? And the husband, is telling her she's crazy. You're making this all up. It makes it very difficult for a person to break out of a verbally abusive relationship because the abuser is hiding it so well from everyone else. It's actually a sign of escalation that it might go to turn to violence when the abuser begins to do it in front of other people. And counselors who work with people who are verbally abused recognize that's a bad sign when it begins to become more public. It's a sign that the abuser may begin to use physical violence. Verbal abuse often escalates over time as the abused person gets used to it and as the abuser gets used to being able to do it. The more conditioned you become to it, the more you'll take. Domestic violence, right? Physical violence is always preceded by verbal abuse. Did you hear that? That doesn't mean all verbal abuse will eventually become physical violence. But any time physical violence takes place, verbal abuse came before. Which tells us that the two are cut from the same cloth, right? That verbal abuse is just verbal violence. It's the intention to do hurt and harm to another person without leaving any scars that anyone can see, but it's cut from the same cloth. One leads easily into the other. That's probably why Jesus said, if you call someone names, you fool, you're in danger of the fires of hell. And he puts it in the same place there in the Sermon on the Mount with the person who murders. Because when you begin with your words to demean the value and worth of another person, it's only a few steps away of saying, so why should I let you live? It's all part of the same. You have to decide in your heart first that the person is not worthy to live. And apparently, it needs to even come out your mouth before you would carry out the act. Very interesting listening to the murderers in Rwanda in this story as they would, you know, talk themselves into killing people. You don't deserve to live. Even if we let you live, your children will be from the wrong tribe and they'll kill our children. All the things they had to do to convince themselves that the other person had no worth and should be slaughtered. So this is what bothers me about verbal abuse and why I wanted to address it here in this context of unwholesome talk. In essence, it is the opposite of God's plan. He designed relationships to be based on love, trust, mutuality, where two together are better than one, where we have the opportunity for creativity, where we can build each other up, where by giving love away, we end up with more than we started with. That was God's plan. That's how the universe really operates. When you break that down and you begin to think, well, anything good to you is bad for me. There's not enough to go around. I have to take the power in order to have any power, because if I give it away, I'll be powerless and worthless myself. When we buy into that reality, we begin to step on other people in order to feel better about ourselves. And guess who invented that reality? Satan. It's not true, but it is the alternate reality to God's. It's the alternate reality where Satan lives. And particularly when Christians buy into that, we are Christians in name only. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So in other words, I can tell you what your worldview is, what reality you live in, by the kind of things that come out your mouth. And if what comes out your mouth is verbal abuse, we can trace that right back to the reality you live with is Satan's reality. You think that in order to be an okay person, you have to smash other people. Wow. The exciting thing is, that's not the real reality. That reality is going to have a short life period during this earth's history, and then it's going to be gone. The God of the universe is unwilling to dominate His creatures, even though maybe we could say He has the right to order us around. The right to treat us like we have no individual identity of our own. He has the right to give us no opinion of our own. But He refuses to do that. In fact, He came here and demonstrated, I would rather die myself than force you to be in a relationship with me. That's how strongly our God feels about not being an abusive parent. How unwilling He is to use His position and the power differential that exists between us to force us into subjection. Love that is forced is no love at all. And God knows that. He's not dumb. He lives in reality. And so He draws us with His loving kindness. And the exciting thing is, we're going to live, if we live there, through all of eternity in that reality. And the rest of the good news is, we need to and we can start to live in that reality even now. So, next time, I had to break this in two parts. Next time, we're going to talk a little bit about how to respond. But if you find yourself in an abusive, verbally abusive situation, how do you respond? What's the appropriate way to respond to that? It's actually very simple to stop verbal abuse if you don't hang around for it. It can go on. But simple doesn't mean easy. Because if it was easy, everybody would have done it by now. So we're going to talk a little bit about the complications and some practical stuff about how to respond.